greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America, and we're heard worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on troubled waters right after this message. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he has to say about law school students. Quote, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. He said it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult homeschool. If you're online, go to the website, it's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, we're taking a look here at troubled waters from Heifer International. They publish a quarterly magazine, news magazine. It's called World Arc. This is the fall 2003 issue. It has a series of articles in here on water. The surprising thing that I discovered about water is that there's only 1% of the water on planet Earth available for human use and consumption. 1%. All the water in the oceans, 97%, is unusable to us. Of the 3% that's left, 2/3 of that, 2% of the total in the world, is locked up in the ice caps down in Antarctica, up in the North Pole, or on Greenland. Only 1% is sitting in lakes and rivers or in underground aquifers. For more information about Heifer International, you can write to 1015 Louisiana Street, Little Rock, Arkansas, 72202. Again, that's Heifer International, 1015 Louisiana Street, Little Rock, Arkansas, 72202. Or you can call direct 1-800-422-0474. Again, that's 1-800-422-0474. I don't know what the price of the magazine is, but whatever it is, it's well worth it. Where have all the rivers gone? You know, many rivers around the world, large and small, are drying up before they reach their natural destinations. In addition to the Colorado River, 5 of the largest rivers in Asia, the Ganges, the Indus, the Yellow, the Amu Darya, and the Sir Darya, no longer reach the oceans for large portions of the year. Channelized rivers such as the Rhine River in Europe and a large stretch of the Missouri River in the United States no longer meander, but rather they flow artificially straight and deep to allow for the shipping and barging of goods. Levees have disconnected the mighty Mississippi River from 90% of its floodplain. Societies have reaped substantial economic rewards from these modifications to rivers, from the generation of hydroelectric power to the expansion of irrigated agriculture to the growth of trade along the shipping routes. However, serious losses have mounted on the ecological side of the register or the ledger, and it has, in their natural state, healthy rivers perform myriad functions such as purifying water, moderating floods, moderating droughts, maintaining habitat for fisheries, birds, and wildlife. And rivers connect the continental interiors with the coasts, bringing sediment to deltas, delivering nutrients to coastal fisheries, and maintaining salinity balances that sustain productive estuaries. From source to sea and from channel to floodplain, river ecosystems gather, store, and move snowmelt and rainwater in synchrony with nature's cycles. The diversity and the abundance of life in running waters reflects millions of years of evolution and adaptation to these natural rhythms. Or 4,300 years, whichever you believe in Noah's flood, or billions and billions of years, as old Carl Sagan used to say. Now, from a strictly human perspective, healthy rivers perform numerous ecosystem services and the processes carried out by natural ecosystems that benefit human societies and economies. Rivers, wetlands, and other freshwater ecosystems constitute part of the natural infrastructure that keeps our economies humming. And like workers in a factory, wetland plants and animals are an organized and productive team, absorbing pollutants and nutrients, decomposing wastes, and churning out fresh, clean water. And even if we knew how to replace all of these valuable functions that rivers perform, it would cost an enormous sum to replace them artificially. The services provided by wetlands alone can be worth on the order of $20,000 per hectare per year. Now, that's about $8,000 per acre per year. Now, in little more than a century, a geologic twinkling of an eye, human societies have so altered rivers that they're no longer adequately performing many of their roles of delivering many of the ecological services that human economies have come to depend on. The significant portion of freshwater species worldwide, including at least 20% of freshwater fish species, are at risk or of risk of extinction or have already become extinct, because floodwaters are no longer getting cleansed by floodplain wetlands. More pollution is reaching inland and coastal seas, causing damage such as low oxygen and the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, the deterioration of Europe's Black Sea. In short, in many parts of the world, the harnessing of rivers for economic gain is now causing more harm than good. Now, they go on to tell a story down here in the Andes Mountains. Alpacas to the rescue. Ecuadorians heifer work to preserve delicate Andean zone and water supply. All over the world, there are ecological reasons for maintaining the status quo with water quality, estuaries, rivers and creeks, groundwater. Well, here in the Andes, there's a unique water storage ecosystem high up in the Andes that's in threat of being destroyed. And indeed, it was in the process of being destroyed. Heifer International, along with the Ecuadorian government, got together and came up with a plan to save it. And it's worth repeating, because what can be done in Ecuador can be done in the Imperial Valley of California, can be done and copied and emulated any place and every place. We see in the scripture God instructed us to dress and keep the garden. Man has not done a very good job of dressing and keeping the garden. We spend more of our time electing socialists and communists to do the job for us, when in reality, the bigger, better job can be done by individuals on their own land. Now, I have a piece of land, and I work on my own land to preserve it. If my neighbors do the same, then there's no need for government and socialist bureaucrats to come around dictating to us as to how we ought to do it, how we ought to maintain soil fertility, or the ecological balance, or streams and rivers. Now listen to this story. In Latacunga, L-A-T-A-C-U-N-G-A, Ecuador, in the shadow of the snow-crested Chimborazo volcano, an unlikely hero, the alpaca, has stepped in to save a fragile high-altitude environmental zone, a vital water source for farms, villages, towns, and cities down below. Heifer International is working with Ecuadorian indigenous communities in the Andes to preserve the zone from destruction by farming and sheep grazing. With help from Heifer, communities are raising alpacas in the zone known as the Paramo, P-A-R-A-M-O. Our intention in having a project with Heifer is to recover what we have lost in water resources, said Demario Tipan. He is the president of a grassroots organization of rural Andean communities near Latacunga, about 60 miles south of Quito, Ecuador. The Paramo's delicate spongy ground cover is vital to the intricate ecology that supplies water to the ecosystems and human communities downhill. These plants soak up snowmelt and abundant rainwater, feeding underground springs that flow into streams and rivers. The farms, towns, and cities at lower elevations rely on this Paramo water as a primary source for their water needs. But farming and grazing in the Paramo disrupt this natural system. Farmers' plows and the sheep's sharp cloven hooves damage the ground cover. In addition, hungry sheep munch the low-growing plants down to the bare ground, destroying the system's ability to collect water and causing soil erosion. Now, unlike sheep, alpacas have soft, padded feet. The indigenous people have been forced into the high-altitude Paramo because of population pressures, poverty, and the sparse availability of land. And they would normally farm and raise livestock in middle and lower elevations that are more tolerant of human activity, said Fernando Lara, Heifer's Ecuador director. Communities taking part in the Heifer initiative, which jointly own the heifer-supplied alpacas, sell valuable yarn and knit sweaters, ponchos, and other items through small businesses that they have set up. This income helps relieve the poverty that pushes indigenous people into the Paramo in the first place. The benefit of the alpaca is that it produces wool and its hooves do not destroy the Paramo. Manure from the alpacas is composted and used as fertilizer to improve topsoil in the middle elevation farms. And what we're trying to do is to have a better life for our brothers and sisters. Our goal is to improve the community and household life conditions, said Tipan. Heifer's Jim DeVries said, "Water is becoming an increasingly important part of livestock and agroecology projects around the world." Water is becoming a more precious resource around the world, he said. From the standpoint of food security and health, water is a huge issue. Heifer concentrates on providing livestock and environmental protection to resource-poor communities around the world. But as in Ecuador, preservation of water supplies and efficient irrigation methods are often important ingredients in Heifer's work, DeVries said. Small-scale farmers frequently have a keen awareness of water resources. There is a motivation you can build on. When you get people organized, they start to envision a better situation for themselves and their families, and they start to act on it. Alpacas were once a common sight in the Ecuadorian Andes, but over time they vanished, and no one is exactly sure why. In the past, alpacas lived in Ecuador, but the alpacas disappeared from Ecuador in the colonial times in the 17th and 18th centuries. There are different hypotheses about why they disappeared. Some believe the alpacas died out from a disease brought in by the Spanish. Others say no. They disappeared because the Spanish prohibited the use of alpacas because they were associated with indigenous religions. Heifer is now helping to reintroduce alpacas into Ecuador and in the high ranges of the Andes. In turn, the graceful, placid alpacas are helping to save the paramo and the water table and the water ecosystem. The alpacas are also helping to beautify the countryside because they're so beautiful, joked Heifer Ecuador's Edwin Chancusig. The alpacas look like a cousin to the llama. The llama also bears fiber, but it's rarely used for clothing. The alpaca's fiber is more valuable. The shortage of land for indigenous people has its roots in the colonial system that allowed gentry to take over huge tracts of highly productive land for haciendas. Let me pause right there and make an observation. Whether you call these haciendas or communal farms or state farms, the bottom line is these huge government-owned pieces of real estate, corporate agribusiness, we call it in the United States, divorces people, individuals from the land. The people who are more interested in the land and land preservation are the people that live on the land, not the absentee landlords at Archer Daniels Midland or Cargill or John Hancock Insurance. The same thing is true in Russia and China. These huge land groupings, I guess we'll call it, corporate agribusiness, we call it in the United States, thousands of acres like J.R. Simplot, I think he farms 9,600 acres of potatoes and hires hundreds of people to grow those potatoes. You know, there was a time when people had small plots of land, 160 acres, and they grew potatoes on their own land and sold those products into the marketplace. Today we have evolved a system of corporate agribusiness. It's nothing new. When the Spanish took over, they created huge land grants, which then makes the people, the local people, landless. We're seeing that now in the United States. In 1920, about 50%, I think it was 43 or 45% of the population lived in the country, lived on the farms, lived out in rural areas. Today, only 3% do. 97% of us in America are locked up in the cities. The people who are concerned about land and the use of the land and take better care of the land are the small land owners, not the big hacienda owners, corporate agribusiness owners, or the industrial agriculture businessmen. That's what the bottom line is. So they have, down in South America, if the church doesn't own the land, the state owns the land, or some huge corporation or public entity owns the land, the people are landless, living on little small plots of ground, trying to eke out a living instead of having 30, 50, 100 acres that they could make their living on. Well, this forced the indigenous people into marginal lands higher up. The best land is taken up by the corporate agribusinesses, and then the junk land is left over for the peons. Acres of greenhouses for the flower industry at lower elevations have added to the land shortage. In recent years, Ecuador's indigenous groups have pushed for redistribution of the hacienda land. and for a more equitable distribution of the water from the Paramo. When Moses went into the promised land, they divided the land up, and Moses gave us a statute, and it said, to the larger families, you take more. Take all the land that you can use, occupy, and possess, just like a smorgasbord. But use all the land that you take. Take all the land you can use, but make sure you use all the land that you take. If you got a small family, you take less land. If you got a big family, you take more land. But the point is, when God divided the land, He gave the land to the people, not to the corporations, the government, and the church. Now, economic conditions have forced these indigenous families to seek work outside of their villages so that they can send money home. Outside of their villages, oh, that's why they come to the United States, to earn money. Land reform in South America would go a long ways toward raising living standards in South America. Some work in the flower industry, others toil in menial jobs in the big cities of Quito and Guayaquil, and still others head east to Ecuador's Amazon region to work in the oil fields. Still others go as far as Spain and Italy to work. Now, we're trying to create less dependence on these external sources of income, Lara said. The availability of water often determines whether a family can stay on its small parcel of land, Tippin said. You can't talk about the family's economy without talking about water, he said, and we're concentrating on preserving the Paramo and its natural resources, especially water, so that our families have something to eat and something to drink. So the primary reason they're up at these high elevations to start with is because the best land has been taken at the lower elevations. Taken by what? Well, by the church, corporate agribusiness, and the state. And the people whose, you know, the purpose for all of this land, the purpose for government, is to benefit the people. The people are reduced to slaves, and a small number of people, the aristocracy, live high on the hog, while the poor people are out here, dirt scrabble farmers, struggling to make a living on marginal land, and then in the process of it, they destroy it. Now let's take a look here at a couple other factors before we get on to the next water story. Listen to this. How should heifer work with youth, especially since the challenges they face today include not only hunger and poverty, but also child labor, sex trafficking, war abuse, AIDS, and many other ills that leave millions without hope for the future? To answer this question, heifer convened a week-long workshop of global staff and partners to seek strategies for working with youth. Participants at the June meeting in St. Petersburg, Russia, were confronted with some sobering statistics. Listen to these four statistics. The United Nations estimates that poverty takes the life of a child every 3 seconds. That's one. Two, Action International estimates that there are 100 million street children in the world today, and that by 2020 there will be 800 million. Three, there are 10.7 million AIDS orphans in Africa alone. And four, the UN says 1 million children were sold into illegal sex trafficking this year. There are four great ills, and of those four great ills, they're caused by four great sins, four great criminal activities. You know, every time I see an article or a story that comes in telling me about, you know, there's this great problem out here and it needs to be solved, and the solution is the United Nations or some new socialist or bureaucratic welfare program or some political intervention needs to be done. I don't think that's the problem. I think the socialists, the communists, and the political interveners have caused more problems than they've ever solved. There isn't anything the government can't do half as well for twice as much. Now let's take a look at these four problems, and let's take a look at what causes these problems. The United Nations estimates that poverty takes the life of a child every 3 seconds. What causes poverty? Has anybody ever thought about poverty? What causes it? Well, lack of money. Is it a lack of money, or is it a lack of the goods that a man needs for his livelihood? Is it money that you're short, or is it food? Is it money that you're short, or is it transportation? Are you short of money, or are you short of clothes? I don't think we need money. I think we need food, clothing, and shelter. And all wealth comes out of the ground. So we need land, number one, and land has to be governed, and is governed, by 15 land laws that God gave us, and by, I think it's 16 economic laws, 16 or 18 along in there somewhere. Economic laws on the land with the land laws produces wealth. And what's happening here in the world, we're not practicing the laws that produce wealth. Those of us that are wealthy are practicing the laws that produce wealth, but what about the poor people? You know, I look at people here in the inner cities of, let's say, Detroit or Philadelphia, and people say, well, see, it's poverty, and what we need are more welfare programs to lift these people out of poverty. What would happen if you gave these people the land and then got off their back so that they could go to work on the land, their labor, working on the land in conjunction with the sun and the rain will produce plants. Plants produce something to sell. Something to sell produces money. Money produces wealth. You know, our forefathers, without OSHA, the EPA, and the State Tax Commission, without government regulations, went out onto the Great Plains, and they built sod houses in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, and by the 1900s, 1910s, and 1920s, those same people had made enough money on their 160-acre plots that they could come into the towns like Lincoln, Nebraska, and Omaha, and build houses, Victorian houses, with wrought iron balustrades and wrought iron fences around them that today have to be divided up into apartments for people to afford to live in them. Real wealth comes out of the ground. Real wealth comes out of the soil. Government gets in the way of producing real wealth by putting regulations in place to protect certain industries and monopolies. That's all that boils down to. And it isn't just in the United States, it's all over the world. Everywhere there's a government, there's excessive regulation, excessive taxation, that if you'd remove it, these people could support themselves. There would be great prosperity if we would obey God and keep His commandments. Now let's take a look at number two. Action International estimates that there are 100 million street children in the world today, and that by 2020 there's going to be 700 million more, a total of 800 million. Why do we have street children? Is it because they're orphaned? And if they're orphaned, is it because their parents were orphaned by AIDS? Why did their parents get AIDS? Did they violate the law that says thou shalt not commit adultery? You know, at the root of every major problem is a broken law or two or three. When we take a look at the laws of God, they're not mere suggestions. When you commit adultery or fornication, you come down with AIDS, you die. You leave widows and orphans. That's not good, boys and girls. Don't you think that we ought to be telling people more? Don't you think that Billy Graham, Oral Roberts, and Jerry Falwell could do a greater service by instructing people in the natural laws set up by God, which if you practice them produces great benefits, and if you violate them produces great curses? Let's take a look at number three. There are 10.7 million AIDS orphans in Africa alone. In order to get AIDS, you have to violate a law. Disease is a penalty for the violation of law. AIDS is a sexually transmissible disease. It comes from dirty needles, which is the art of the apothecary, drug abuse. Drug abuse is witchcraft. Witchcraft is punishable by death. When you die, your children become orphans. And when you practice adultery or fornication, you get the same result. The punishment is death. And it can be by AIDS, herpes, or VD. The fourth one here, the UN says 1 million children were sold into illegal sex trafficking this year. Well, you know, people who practice or are loose morally don't teach their children to be sexually moral, now do they? And when people are selling their children into the sex traffic, or the children dishonor their parents and run away from home and get caught up in sex trafficking, they call this the sex workers. In the Bible, they're called whores. That's all. Now, the purpose for whoredom is to make money. And there's a law that prohibits whoredom, sodomy, bestiality. You know, there are laws that require us to live moral lives. It's a wild new concept, I know, for a lot of you, but if you violate those laws, there are penalties to pay. And oftentimes, the children pay those penalties. All right, hang on here a minute. We got to take a break. You're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest sponsored by the Gordon Law School. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press of political and social activities free from government surveillance. You know, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes, we call them politicians, beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes. They want more spending and gun control. But you know, you and I have not heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years now, have we? And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from our political process, politicians, lawyers, or bureaucrats. Now, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power and I care not who makes the laws." Well, give me the judicial power and I care not who makes the laws either. Because the real power in America is in the courts, not politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into the power of our courts, why don't you call 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for home education. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the email. Send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, I just thought I'd share with you the facts that, in reality, when we violate laws, there's a penalty. There's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. So when you're looking at AIDS orphans, there was a broken law involved there. Somebody dies of AIDS, there's a broken law involved there. You go to a cemetery, you find a gravestone, and you add up the birth date and the death date, and the guy lived 47 years. That's a breach of contract. That's a violation of law. And these broken laws manifest themselves in a number of ways. And every time you have a broken law, you're looking at a penalty. Because there's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. Now let's take a look at Plan B, rescuing a planet under stress and a civilization in trouble. Humanity crossed a threshold back in 1980. For the first time, our activities outpaced the planet's ability to regenerate. Or so writes author Lester Brown, a leading thinker on environmental and economic issues. Wow. God, I'm glad I met this guy. He's a leading thinker. Leading thinker. This guy went to Harvard or Yale or someplace, and he studied leading thinking. And now he has become a leading thinker. And the rest of us, if we can think at all, must be following thinkers. We have leading thinkers and following thinkers, and the leading thinkers are the people who write books, and they're the movers and shakers. Now let's see what our leader here has for us. Between 1950 and 2000, the world population ballooned from 2.5 million to 6.1 million. Excuse me, put a B on that, that's billion. Billion is in boy. World demand for grain tripled, water demand tripled, and fossil fuel use quadrupled. Now, over the past 50 years, new technology has allowed humans to pump more water from aquifers than ever before. So much that natural systems cannot recharge the underground reservoirs. Species extinction is now 1,000 times the national rate, or natural rate, I should say, Brown says, and the Earth is seeing the greatest mass extinction of species since the demise of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. He says. All right, now our leading thinker says 65 million years ago the dinosaurs were dying out. I don't think this guy's a thinker. I think he's a follower. Because if he was a thinker, he wouldn't be espousing evolutionary philosophy. Evolutionary philosophy is religion. I don't think we need religion to solve our water problems and our ecological problems. I think we need legal solutions, and the legal solutions are laid out clearly in the Bible. And when you violate those laws, there are penalties that come around and whap you up alongside the head. I'm suspicious of our leading thinker already. But our leading thinker goes on to say in Plan B, rescuing a planet under stress and a civilization in trouble, Brown paints a grim portrait of a planet in trouble. He goes on to say, as we consume the Earth's natural capital, the Earth's capacity to sustain us is decreasing, Brown says. We are a species out of control, setting in motion processes that we do not understand with consequences that we cannot foresee. You know, that's exactly what God told us. He said, dress and keep the garden. Planet Earth is our garden. We were instructed to dress and keep it. Now, there are 15 agricultural laws, 15 laws that regulate the use of land, God, our Creator, not 65 million years ago, but about 6,000 years ago, instructed our first parents, Adam and Eve, now this is the way this thing has to be run. You know, things like land Sabbaths, Jubilee years, we don't practice that here. We practice organophosphates. Chemical fertilizers, chemical sprays. Why, we're modern and up to date. I mean, you know, we're industrial farmers. And again, where there's a broken law, there's a penalty. He goes on to say, the way we've been doing things for the last 50 years or so, Brown calls it Plan A, and that is not working. Oh, okay. I'll go along with that. We can see that what's going on around us isn't good. Now, Plan B is Brown's proposal for saving the Earth and humanity. And Brown's plan includes, now, all right, now, boys and girls, get your pencils out here. Sharpen it on both ends so we can get this down. Here comes our leading thinker now. Plan B, he says, stabilizing the world population at about 7.4 billion through investments in education, health care, and family planning. All right, we're going to stabilize the world's population at 7.4 billion. Well, why didn't we already stabilize the world's population at 6 billion, 5 billion, 4 billion, or 3 billion? We've been practicing birth control for a good long time now. Do you believe that birth control, do you think that you're going to get over there to India or to Africa, and you're going to control birth control, or control populations through birth control, over what period of time did he say? 7.4 billion. We've got to do it, but he didn't put a date on there, did he? And what is he suggesting? Well, we need family planning. Okay, now we've been doing that. We need health care. Yeah, we've been doing that, but why do we need health care if we want to stabilize population? Don't we want more people to die? I mean, come on. If you give everybody in the world the same health care that you give people in the United States, You're not going to stabilize population at 7.4 billion. You need more people to die. You've got to have fewer people being born and more people dying to stabilize the population. If you want to test this, take a pair of cats. Let them breed, and mama cat will produce about 6 or 8 offspring. Just leave her alone now, and she and that tomcat will breed again. She'll have 3 or 4 litters of kittens per year. 2 cats at the end of a year can produce 24 offspring. All of those offspring, and we'll assume there's 12 boys and 12 girls. You don't need 12 boys and 12 girls. You just need one boy with 12 girls. But we got 12 girl cats. And the second year, the same 2 cats will produce another 24 offspring. And the 12 offspring, the 12 females, will also produce 24. At the end of the second year, you'll have 12 times 24, which is 288 plus 24. You got that? You'll have 300 kittens and cats at the end of 2 years. You know, at some point in time, you've got to introduce something that keeps that cat population stable. Now, we have cats here on the farm, and we have coyotes and hawks and buzzards and eagles. And, you know, there's natural predators that come around here, and they eat those cats. There's nothing like a big barn owl, you know, to come down at night and scoff up a kitten or two. Well, human beings are the same, you know, and this guy here is saying, well, our great leader here, our leading thinker, he says we need more health care. I would say we need less health care, more family planning, which means more abortion, and we need investments in education. Well, wait a minute. Let me think about this for a minute. We Americans are spending $6,300 per child in public school, and we got most of our children in public schools, 47 million of them. Are you telling me that if we were to spend $12,600, we can achieve this goal? You mean if we double the amount of money we spend on education, that's going to bring us utopia? You know, we've been adding more money. We've been spending more money on education over the last 75 years, and it has not alleviated our problems. It has exacerbated our problems. We got greater overpopulation. We have greater poverty. We have greater water pollution. Everything that's wicked and evil is greater, and there's more of it, and everything that's righteous and good, there's less of it, or it's been extinguished. And if there's an exception to that, send me an email, let me know what it is, would you? Next item, our leader tells us, moving from a carbon-based to a hydrogen-based economy. God, that's a wonderful thought. All right, let's go do it. Can you tell me where the hydrogen store is so that I can go down this afternoon and get some hydrogen instead of carbon? You know, the marketplace would solve this problem. The marketplace. If you'd get government out of automotive and you'd let people invent things, somebody would come up with a hydrogen-powered car. You can forget about Detroit coming up with this. But this is the solution this guy is espousing. These solutions that are being espoused here are the same old communist, socialist, utopian solutions that have failed over the last 100 years and are bound and doomed to fail over the next 100 years. The thing that made America great was mom and dad and 160 acres in Nebraska get off their butts and let them go to work. And they did, and they produced great wealth. And then we came along and said, we got too many people that are too successful. What we need is an income tax, OSHA, the EPA, and we need a Department of Labor, a Department of Employment. We've got to have regulation and control to slow these people down. And we did. And we slowed them down, and our productivity is so low. Our savings is so low. We have polluted the equities of our laws. We have polluted the monetary system. I mean, just take a look around you. Yeah, there are solutions, but the solutions don't come from more socialism and more communism. Then he wants to reduce dependence on automobiles. Okay, so what should we do? Go back to horses and buggies? The Amish do. Well, what do you want to depend on? If we're not going to depend on automobiles, what is it that we're going to depend on? And did you know that one job out of every five in America is connected with the automobile? 20% of all employment in this country is connected with automobiles. It's either somebody working for the oil companies, or it's a mechanic that's fixing your car, or it's the car wash down the street, or, you know, 20% of all employment in this country comes directly or indirectly from automobiles. And so what you people are saying is, well, we need is fewer cars. What are you gonna do? What are we gonna do? Go into the buggy whip business? Are we gonna open up buggy whip factories? And who's going to decide how many buggy whip factories we need? And who's gonna work in these buggy whip factories? And who's gonna build the buggies? And man, come on, you know, here comes more of this socialism. When the price of gasoline gets to $5.70 a gallon, which is what the price is in Great Britain, then the auto industry will build fewer SUVs because there will be fewer people buying them. Now, the other day, there was a neat car that I saw come out. It's put out by Honda. I think I reported on it here not too long ago. This car has got an electric motor in it as well as an engine. It gets 50 to 55 miles to the gallon. It's a hybrid car. It's part electric and part gas. It works like a diesel electric locomotive on the railroad. We have a diesel engine producing electricity. The locomotive runs on electricity, and we produce the electricity from the diesel engine that drives the generator. That's what they do with these automobiles. Now, the other day, I was out in an SUV, and the guy that was driving me around pointed out that it gets 25 miles to the gallon. I was really surprised. It's a Chevrolet Sierra or something or like that. Pretty nice SUV. And we went out to Reno, Nevada, and he drives 400 miles. He fills it up 30, 40 gallons of gas and runs 400 miles. Pretty good mileage. I can remember 1957, my dad had a 57 Chevy. He got 8 miles to the gallon uphill and downhills. I would say that from 8 to 24, that's three times greater mileage. I think that's pretty good. I think going from 25 to 50 is even better. But I don't think it ought to be mandated by government. I think that when the price of gasoline, when the marketplace tells you what gasoline is worth. And then here's another thing. If you want to produce more gas and oil, if you would remove all of the environmental restrictions from oil, and oil production, what you do is you make a penalty for the violation of the law. When you pollute the land, then we come in with a penalty. Today, you can't drill for oil. And the reason you can't is you can't come up with the environmental impact statement money. That costs you $100,000 just for the environmental impact statement, which leaves only Mobil and Exxon in the marketplace. Those are the socialists and the communists, the big corporations. Well, anyway, let's go on to the next one. He says, crafting market systems that tell the ecological truth through higher taxes on environmentally destructive activities and credits for ecologically sound practices. Now, that's just pure communism there. Who's going to decide what is economically sound or what is ecologically sound and what is ecologically unsound? Who's going to play God there? Evidently, government is going to do that, isn't it? So the guy says, well, we got these problems, and we've got death pill A and death pill B. So why don't you choose which one you want? I want to choose the white life pill. I'm going to take care of my own land, and I'm going to take care of my own water. And if you'll do the same, and if the neighbor down the street will do the same, in fact, you know, if everybody in the world would dress and keep the guard and obey God and keep his commandments, we wouldn't have these problems. We wouldn't have communism. We wouldn't need it. But as long as we're going to break these laws, we're going to get penalties. And when we get penalties, that isn't very pleasant. And so along comes a leading thinker. And you want to know what this leading thinker, or where this guy comes from? Well, Brown is a former Federal Agriculture Department analyst. He's the founder of the influential environmental research organization World Watch Institute, and more recently, the Earth Policy Institute. This guy is a paid professional communist socialist thinker, leading us. And he's not leading us according to the laws of God to dress and keep the garden. He's leading us according to the corporate game plan into more socialist communist ideology so that we can create bigger and bigger corporate agribusiness industries who can pollute more water and who can consume more labor and produce less, consume more and produce less, and in the process make more landless peasants. At the same time that they create more and more wealth and create bigger and bigger farms, bigger and bigger land holdings that will pollute the land and the water and everything else around us more and more. In other words, we can have a whole lot more of the same, only on a bigger, grander scale, by following our leading thinker. I think we've been following too many of these leading thinkers. They want to reduce the consumption of livestock, particularly beef, in industrial nations. Well, they got a point there. The beef that's being produced in the United States primarily comes from feedlots. These feedlots feed a lot of chemicals to their animals, and they feed bypass protein. That is, they cannibalize animals and feed meat byproducts to herbivores. And that's bad, and it creates disease, and it violates the law of God, and we ought not to be doing it. And the cattle that we're eating, the meat that we're eating, is unsafe, and I wouldn't touch it. I don't eat that kind of crap. And this guy says, well, we ought to cut that down. I don't think you ought to cut down on your meat consumption. I think you should cut down on your fat and blood consumption and cut down on your unclean meat consumption. If you would eat clean meat that's lean, without fat, bled well, there's nothing wrong with eating meat. In fact, it's more healthful and nutritious than being a vegetarian. And by the way, vegetarianism does not come from the Bible. Vegetarianism comes from India. It's a pagan religious philosophy and ideology. Now, if you're a vegetarian, that's fine. Go ahead and be a vegetarian. But don't preach to us about how vegetarianism comes from the Bible, because it doesn't. And Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14 plainly tell you these are the kinds of meats you should eat, and these are the kind of meats that you shouldn't eat. And here again, when we eat these unclean meats, when we eat fat and blood, and after all, it's your government and leading thinkers like Brown who create the laws that put 30% fat into your hamburger, which then you go to McDonald's and eat 30% fat and wonder why you're getting fat, obese, sick, and filled with heart disease and stroke. Hey, you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar here or a genius to figure this out. Plan B, Rescuing the Planet. 1984, Brown began publishing and the widely read annual State of the World reports that assesses the planet's environmental health. To those who've read Brown's previous work, Plan B will have a familiar ring. In Eco Economy, Building an Economy for the Earth, published in 2001, Brown suggested that many economists have operated under incorrect assumptions. The environment is not simply a part of the economy. The economy is a part of the environment. Brown says that we need to structure the world economy to be compatible with environmental realities. Plan B, in many ways, is a restatement of this earlier work, but Brown's critics may think Plan B sounds more like Plan 9, the one from outer space. No, I don't think it comes from outer space. I think it comes from Moscow and Peking, China. This is just a rehash of communist ideology that has failed in China and failed in Russia. So let's put it into operation in the United States, where it's going to fail over here. Now, if failure is what you want, well, then you're on the right track. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. Brown's call for tax shifting, new directions in energy policy, and sweeping transformations of world systems may strike some as dreamy and radical. Yeah, it requires big government to come in here and direct our lives. And any mention of family planning in relation to public policy always generates a reaction. I think you should have family planning. I think you should plan on having many, many children. God told you to be fruitful and multiply. But you can't do that in the city. And when you move to the city, you handicap yourself. I can understand why people in the city only want one child. It's all you can afford. Maybe that's one too many. Living out here in the country, you know, I raised a dozen children. I could raise two dozen right now. I got more food, clothing, and shelter than I can use. I've got a garden down here. Those little bread snappers can work in. They can work out here on the range. They can work in the woods. I've got plenty of work for all kinds of bread snappers. And in the early days of America, most of us lived on the rural side of the ledger rather than the urban side. And we had big families. And I can understand Americans having small families. I lived in the city. I struggled to feed my children. I struggled to make enough money to pay my taxes, pay my bills, and provide education and a living for my children, my family. I understand that. I'm not divorced from reality. But more communism isn't going to solve this problem. What we need are more people moving out on more of the land, and then those individuals living on their own land. When you own 50 acres of land, I'll just bet you that you'll take a whole lot better care of it than an employee for J.R. Simplot is going to take care of it. There's just nothing like home ownership to make people take care of something. And, of course, the land in America is in the hands of government. Do you think Ranger Rick is out there taking better care of the public lands than the individual that actually lives on the land, makes his living on the land? I tell you, no, he doesn't. He collects his paycheck. He does what he's told. He follows the manual. He's outside the box, and he cannot think. Now, that's where communism and socialism have led us, and that's where they're going to continue to lead us. Now, Heifer International is worth buying. I'm just taking that one particular item and drubbing them a little bit on this because, you know, when you take these communist utopian solutions and you say, well, this is what we need to do, this is exactly what we've been doing, there's not an original thought in this guy Brown's head. All of it comes from socialist and communist planning. Well, I'm about out of time. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour has been brought to you by the Gordon Law School as an educational service in the public interest. Now, if you'd like more information about The Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. And for more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, go to the webpage, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and a biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal that says that our time is about up, so we're going to have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.